This is Sound and Query, the Southern Illinois University Medical Library's podcast. I'm Lydia Howes, your host and one of many friendly librarians here. Tune in for information about SIU Medicine's activities and research, library events and resources, and anything else that we deem interesting. Previously on Sound and Query, we spoke with Tracy Smith, the Director of Population and Community Health Integration at SIU, about her efforts to encourage collaboration between the local healthcare and law enforcement communities. Today I'm here with Ricky Castles, one of Springfield's neighborhood police officers, to hear her perspective on these programs and why they're so important. I'm excited that we can hear from someone on the law enforcement side, so thanks so much for coming talking to me.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Let's do it.
So just jumping right in what ways from your experience are law enforcement and healthcare connected?
I'd say they're completely indirectly related to each other. The majority of calls that we have are probably due to some kind of mental illness or some kind of mental illness within the family or an issue within the family that's causing other problems. Like a domestic battery might be because, you know, a woman hit a man or a man hit a woman. But there could potentially be an alcohol abuse or a substance abuse problem, which is a mental health issue. So even something that seems completely unrelated to mental health, such as a domestic battery or a theft or a robbery, could be related to substance abuse, which is also a mental health issue. And then there's the more simplistic things. We get called all the time for, you know, somebody talking to themselves walking down the street or the different hospitals and stuff, people that want to hurt themselves. We get called as a kind of a first responder when nobody else knows, like when the family doesn't know who to call, they just call the police. So we get there, and if somebody wants to hurt themselves as a community caretaker, we have to make sure that person gets medical treatment. And then we kind of pass the buck. It almost seems like where it goes from us to the hospital, and then we lose custody of that person, and that's it until next time we get called to deal with them or there's another incident with them. I mean, it's all very intricately connected.
This is the first time I've really heard about law enforcement and the healthcare community really trying to work closely together. Mm-hmm. How long do you think these collaborations have been?
I think we all work. I mean, we work together every day. Every day, I'd probably say one out of every six calls, you know, we call for an ambulance. Or we'll have to take somebody to the hospital. We don't always take them by ambulance, but if they want to go to the hospital or maybe they're a homeless person, they have nowhere else to go and they got back pain. So we'll give them a ride to the hospital because we don't know what else to do with them, really. You know, it's kind of a society issue, but we're the last person they want to talk to and really sometimes the only person they get to talk to. So we try to come up with solutions. And I think I've been on for 11 years, and throughout those 11 years, nothing has ever changed. It's always been, we work very closely together, but we work super closely and nothing ever gets completely resolved. It's just like we put the Band-Aid on it and, hey, we'll take you to the hospital. And then when the hospital releases you, we'll see you tomorrow. And then we'll take you to the hospital again. And then we will continue the same thing.
That sounds like it might be a little bit frustrating. Mm-hmm. Can you think of any ways, I mean, even just pie in the sky, mm-hmm. in a perfect world, how do you think those processes could be improved?
I wish there was like a database maybe, there is a database. That's what we're trying to work on now, is keeping better records within the department. And my supervisor, who also happens to be my father, he's been like the liaison between us, the police department, and the medical field to try to come up with some kind of solution. Say that I get called to somebody that wants to kill themselves, or this is probably a typical scenario. It's like 50 degrees at night and 70 degrees during the day. Well, it's starting to get too cold for them to be outside at night, and you're a homeless person. So you're going to call 911 and say, I want to hurt myself or I want to kill myself, because you know that's going to get you into the hospital because the shelters won't take you because possibly you have a substance abuse problem or you drink too much or something like that. So I will get out with you and talk to you. I will put you in the ambulance, go to the hospital, fill out the paperwork that says this person says they wanted to harm themselves. I don't believe they should be let out of the hospital until, you know, they seek medical treatment. And then they see the mental health team at the hospital, and the mental health team says, yeah, you're free to go. Okay, go. I think there needs to be something where there's some kind of follow-up, or after I get out with that person, I should probably call somebody from mental health to make sure that tomorrow, I say tomorrow because a lot of times these calls come like at midnight, and I know that not everybody works the same hours we work. But maybe tomorrow somebody from mental health can go talk to that person, or somebody that deals with veterans can go talk to that person and see what kind of help is available for them. There needs to be some better communication, I think. And there's a lot of really good groups that I've just come in contact with through my father and this recent collaboration that we've all had. And I had no idea these groups existed. I don't think they realized that the police department had the same kind of goals.
To your end, since you have been introduced to these groups, what type of collaborations or programs are they working on? And have you seen any improved outcomes since you've been more involved?
Oh, yes and no. The ideas are there. They don't always go the way they're supposed to go. I know, like the other day, this is a good example. I was just working on something at the department, and a man had come in, said that he wanted to go to AA right now. He has a drinking problem. He wants to go to AA, and it's like 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know where to go. So I called, again, my father, because he's kind of the one that's been working on all these things. And I said, what can I do? This guy wants to go to AA. He's homeless, but he's a really nice guy. He was clean cut. He was real sweet. He kept calling me sweetheart. And he's just like a really nice guy. And he's like, well, ask him if he's a vet. Okay, well, he is a vet. He can't go to the shelter because he got banned for using his phone from the shelter for 3 weeks or something like that. So the next day, I took him to the hospital because he had been walking out in the rain so much, his feet were starting to turn real bad. I took him to the hospital. I gave him my card, my name, and I said, where are you going to be at tomorrow at noon? He told me he was going to be at the library. He always goes to the library and does what he does there. I said, okay, I'm going to have my dad. He's going to supervise you and come meet you there tomorrow, along with somebody from the veterans group, and they're going to try to get you set up somewhere. So there was some kind of follow through. So just, I think, having this collaboration kind of instilled in me that there is something more we can do. Normally, it would just be like, okay, you're going to the hospital. I'm going to drop you off there, and my hands are clean, and you're not my problem anymore. You know, not sounds really harsh, but it's, like I said, a Band-Aid solution for the night as opposed to a permanent solution.
Jumping back a little bit to some of the things that were discussed at the Brown Bag, We heard a lot about crisis intervention training. One of the big things that I pulled out of the Brown Bag was knowing when, if you're making a 911 call, knowing to request a CIT officer. And I was wondering, are you a CIT?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about what that training entails and what it's like?
Yeah. Basically, it's a week-long training, and then we continue training while we're part of the team. We continue training, I think it's like twice a year or something, is what we're supposed to do. Basically, each day is kind of a different thing throughout the week. Like, we meet with different mental health professionals, different social agencies. And then the day that I remember most specifically, and this has been like 7 or 8 years since I went through it, but the day that I most specifically remember was when we had people from 200 Westlake. It's like a live-in facility. We had some of them, the people that live there, come and talk to us about their mental health problems, like what their struggles with, and what they needed from us, basically, like when we come and they're in a crisis mode, what they want us to do and how we should respond and how we shouldn't respond. And then we did scenarios too, like we would play out different scenarios and how they would want us to talk to them or how they would not want us to talk to them. And I think that was helpful. And I think really just being a compassionate person is probably the most helpful thing. I mean, really, it's just kind of like, you know, what anybody wants to be talked to. If you're in a crisis of any sort, whether it's a mental crisis or whatever, you don't want somebody yelling at you. You want somebody just to talk to.
Yeah. And I think that it goes back to, even though sometimes in the back of our head, we know that compassion is going to bring us the best results.
Right.
It can be hard to bring that into play when you are faced with this.
Oh, yeah.
With some situations.
And some people have more patience than others, you know, and some officers have had a bad day at home, or they're going through something at home where the last thing they want to do is get called to this person the fifth time in a row during the week that, you know, I know you don't want to kill yourself. You just don't have anywhere to go or something. It's really easy to be insensitive to something like that. But there's an underlying factor of why that person's calling us every night. There's a reason that that person needs help, you know. And it just might take a little bit of extra work and some compassion. So
as a bystander, and for whatever reason I need to call 911, what situations would you suggest we make that special request?
Well, the good thing is we listen for it too, and our dispatchers listen for it. So a lot of times if there's a mental health call or something that sounds like it would be, they will request, you know, whatever available CIT officer respond. Usually those types of calls are people that have had dealings with local mental health professionals that know about us. They will request us, people that have a history of schizophrenia or depression, Bipolar disorder is something that we see a lot of people that request us. I've yet to have people like, you know, we see a ton of drug abuse and alcohol abuse, and I've yet to see really anybody request us because they're drunk or, you know, anything like that. But I mean, really, that's like I said several times, that's a mental disorder in itself. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the biggest thing we deal with in my job and probably in society. I would say it's probably like one of the biggest things. So,
yeah, I would say that's one of the under-recognized mental health issues.
Definitely.
And what do you think, maybe some other issues that we might not immediately connect with mental health, have you seen?
I think the increase in youth violence is something that we've seen throughout my 11 years, and especially, and I think in the last 5 years, there's been a huge issue in the area I work, especially with younger kids having access to firearms or access, not even firearms, but like knives or anything, and hurting each other or hurting each other's families and stuff. And I think that is a mental health issue also. And I wish there was something more, maybe more of a social awareness that it's a mental health issue so that we can have something to do about it. So that maybe in the schools we can get some better counseling or something to deal with these exceptionally violent children. Or not bad children, but kids that think it's okay to exude that kind of violence towards each other.
Yeah.
Because that's not, I mean, it's not something that kids are born innocent and good, babies are good, and then they're taught these things, or there's a lack of something in their life that's leading them to believe that this is okay. My dad always says, when you have a kid, somebody's going to raise it. It's going to be the church, it's going to be the school, it's going to be your family, or if none of that, if they have no support system, it's going to be the street is going to raise those kids. And that's what's happening to a lot. I think a lot of these younger kids just don't have a positive support system, and I think we need to have a better social construction where we can identify these kids. We have identified these kids, but not just identify them, get them the help they need or some kind of constraint so we can help them to make society better, because it seems like it just keeps getting worse and worse. And there's like been a break in the system in like the last 40 years or something, where I don't know if people have just been having children too young, or there's just, I don't know what it is. I don't know what's led to it, but there has been like this break where now there's this young generation of kids that don't have it's almost like they don't have a moral code. They don't, or sadly, even they don't expect to live. I mean, you hear it a lot. They're not ready to die, but they know it's going to happen. They live their life as though there's no hope. That's what it is. There's no hope for them. I don't know where the breakdown's coming in, but they have it built into their head somehow from their family or their background. They have no support system. And I don't know. I don't know how to fix that.
So if anybody listening has any suggestions.
Yes, please let me know if you know how to fix the world.
Or if you don't know how to fix the world, but you're interested in helping, then get in contact with me or someone at SIU or law enforcement. And you can join in on all of the meetings and programs that we're trying to get off the ground.
We have meetings every month at the department. We just had one last Wednesday where it's all sorts of different. It's people from rehab centers, people from mental health, people from the court system, us. And we all just sit together at the table and talk about what's been going on and where we're at, basically, on trying to get the ball rolling to make things a little better in Springfield.
So we've mostly been talking about healthcare, since this is the School of Medicine. Mm-hmm. But can you think of any other sectors of the community that you think it would be helpful to start building collaborations with?
I don't know. I think it all kind of works together. Like I've noticed, and I almost get confused sometimes because we'll have meetings with SIU, and then we also have meetings with a lot of the homeless shelters and stuff. And I get them all mixed up. I'm like, okay, is this an SIU meeting or a home? But really, it's all the same. I mean, it's all people that are in some kind of crisis, and there's different resources they can go to, and none of those resources seem to work together. And we're trying to make it so that all these resources can work together and make the world a little better place, which sounds cheesy, but that's really what it is. I mean, how can it be easier for everybody, easier for you guys, easier for us, you know, not to have to deal with things the way we are dealing with them, because it's not working.
Yeah. And I wonder sometimes, because I feel like in today's society, we are just moving so far away from community. Mm-hmm. And we can call ourselves a community, but it does take some sort of action. You have to do more than saying we're part of the same community. We have to understand all of the bits and pieces and know what's going on and communicate with each other.
Yeah. And you can't make people do that. You can't make them be compassionate. But having really strong routines or certain ways that we're supposed to do things by getting really strong processes, I think helps with that too, because maybe you get a less compassionate person, but you know that there is a process they're going to have to go through, and they're going to have to get a hold of mental health or get a hold of the homeless shelter. So as long as that's getting done, even if you're not the most compassionate person, it would still be helpful to know that that's getting done.
Yeah, have some sort of procedure that at least will mimic compassion.
Yeah, yes. I'm built in. compassion procedure.
Yeah. And so that if you're not feeling compassionate that particular day, because I think most people are compassionate, but you,
every once in a while,
you have the day where it all goes out the window. Yeah.
Well, thanks again for speaking with me. I do feel like I've learned a lot, and I think those listening will as well. If anyone listening would like to watch the brown bag, there will be a recording linked below. So go ahead and listen to that, and otherwise, have a nice day. Thanks for listening to Sound and Query. For more information about the SIU Medical Library, its services and resources, or to learn about future events and podcasts, please visit our website at www.siumed.edu/lib.